Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, and welcome to a Smart Talk road trip. This is a very special Smart Talk road trip. We are at the Susquehanna Art Museum on 3rd Street in Midtown Harrisburg to mark the museum's exhibit, Picasso, A Life in Prints. The exhibit features more than 40 prints from one of history's most iconic and versatile artists, Pablo Picasso. The exhibit comes from collector and director of the John Soki Gallery in New York. John Soki is our guest on today's program. John Soki, welcome to the program. So let's talk a little bit about Picasso to begin the program. Why is Picasso such an iconic figure in art history?
He broke new ground on every level you can think of, from subject matter to technique, how to bring it to the public. He's just an innovator every which way.
And that versatility, I think, is something that makes him unique as well, in that he was not just someone who was a cubist or, considered, Prince, for example, was something he kind of experimented with, if you will, but a writer and a lecturer and all those things. So that versatility made him a little bit different than many other artists.
Well, he came from an artistic background. His father was an art teacher. And very early on in life, when he was a little kid already, he was just drawing and drawing and drawing. And he actually had trouble at school because he would be, on purpose, be disrespectful. So they sent him to a classroom alone and locked him in there. And that's what he wanted, so he can do his artwork. And when he was 5, 6, 7 years old. So it was in him. There was a tremendous talent there. And he just managed to unlock that talent all throughout the 90 years he lived.
They literally locked him in there?
He had it. He didn't lose it. He innovated. For example, the Cubist period, which is one of the most important of the 20th century, that only lasted 7 or 8 years, and it's a very small body of work, but it changed everything where we are now.
Yeah, for those listening, and we'll provide some background to define and identify some of these terms that we're discussing today. Cubism, what is cubism?
It's an entirely new way of rendering things, to reduce it to its composite elements to the extent that it's not even recognizable, but it's supposed to be recognizable, but sometimes it's hard. And When it first came out, it people couldn't understand it. And some of the artists, for example, like Matisse, who was influenced a great deal by Picasso, never really adopted it. But Picasso and his friend Braque, they took it to a level and then just moved on in life.
How would you describe cubism, though? It the word cube in there means a great deal.
These are geometric elements instead of rendering of the body itself or the subject matter itself. So it's composed of squares, rectangles, reduced to these forms and shapes.
And, it's. I think there are many people that, if you ask them, describe a Picasso to me, they have in mind what they think a typical Picasso would look like. Well, when you look at this exhibit and you visit this exhibit, you can see that there probably is not a typical Picasso. But cubism, I would think that many people would associate with Picasso because he was such a pioneer in that area.
That's absolutely correct. But the point I wanted to make is that what he's so well known for, that was just a minor little part of his work and his whole being. That was just something which he did a couple of years and then he moved on.
Mm-hmm. This exhibit, there are 45 prints. And again, to define, what is a print?
The point is really that he used his skills to illustrate his life to himself as well as to the world. If you look around, most of the images are portraits. That's the people in his life. And many of the events, actual events which happened, and if you look very carefully, usually in the upper right corner, there is a series of numbers. Now, the numbers are in reverse order, but it's the date when he did it. So By looking at the pictures, you have a diary of Picasso. You know what happened on those days, and you can read as to which girlfriend he is with, and what friends he is with, and what's happening, and so on. So this is really a diary of his life.
And as you point out, and you can see even in this exhibit, that when you read about the actual piece that you're looking at, that there are many of them that are modeled after actual people. A lot of times, wives, girlfriends, mistresses, other people that he has come into contact with. But let's face it, for the most part, they are not portraits.
Well, the people are recognizable, at least for somebody who has been dealing with it like I do. They clearly tell you as to which person is he trying to show. And for example, the very first beautiful portrait he did of Marie Therese, his long-standing first lover, I mean first lover meaning officially, he was married to a woman called Olga, and he couldn't release the image because Olga didn't know that he has been sleeping with Marie Therese.
That's a little bit of a problem, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. But she found out eventually.
Yeah.
and she got even.
How'd she get even?
Oh, she got even, all right. She never let him go. She, until her dying days, she wouldn't give him a divorce.
See, now, the story a lot of times goes that, like with his second mistress, that he wouldn't give a divorce.
Your second wife you're talking about?
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
That was late in life. He only had two marriages,
right,
Olga.
Right.
And when Olga died in the mid-50s, then he married Jacqueline.
Right. But the story that I had heard is that he wouldn't give a divorce to her, the second wife.
Well, that's possible. I don't remember that he would ask for it. I wasn't there, but...
Well, we're just trying to narrow this down.
Okay.
I want to go back to his Picasso's childhood. Pablo Picasso was born in Spain. As you mentioned, his father was an artist. Picasso went to two art schools, but even though he flourished because he had natural talent, I guess when I ask the question is, how much does someone like Picasso learn in an art school as compared to his natural talent?
Nothing.
That's
nothing
what I thought. That's what I figured. Like, you want to talk about that a little bit more? I mean, is this something he was born with?
It's very simple. He was always ahead of the curve. It also has something to do not only with his talent, but his personality. He was 17, 18 years old and belonged to this artistic group, first in Barcelona and up in Paris. And he was the leader. And people there were 22, 23, 5, 8 years older, but he was the leader. He was a leader by nature. And if he didn't become an artist, he would have been a very successful businessman or sports figure. I don't know, but he had an innate quality in him which you couldn't suppress.
Mm. So, you know, when you look at these prints, many of them have titles in French. As I said, Picasso was born in Spain. When did he go to France?
In the turn of the century, but the titles were not given to him. He never titled. There's one print. I think.
And for our radio audience, he's pointing it out here.
That big black and white print in the back, right?
I'm looking at
Egyptian. Egyptian, yeah. And that's the only print which he titled. He didn't title it, but I'll tell you a story in a second. So the titles are given by people who write the book. They write the books or whatever. And different books by the same writer would have different titles. So that's meaningless. What we define it in the trade is the dates. We go by the dates. And if anybody tells me I have this Picasso print, which is called so-and-so, means nothing, really. Now, the Egyptian, that is a print of a very, very unhappy, aggressive, miserable person. And that was when Gillot, the only girlfriend who left him, just packed her bags and disappeared because they didn't get along. They lived in the south of France, and she just had enough. She had two kids. She packed the two kids and went back to Paris. And he was angry because no woman ever left him. And he made this picture, and it's called the Egyptian because it looks like an Egyptian drawing by an Egyptian. right?
It's kind of like walking like one.
It's a tough image. And the studio where they printed it, they started to call it the Egyptian. And that's the title of that because of this all this anger reflecting there in this foreign way, if you will.
Well, to describe it for our radio audience, it is, you can see the anger because of the colors. It is very stark, black and white. Then when you get a little bit closer, you can understand. You know, one of the things that, and this isn't unique to Picasso, but there is a print that, from our vantage point, is just to the right of the Egyptian. And one of the things that struck me as I was looking around this morning is how small it is. But with the size is how intricate it is. And all of these prints are just so intricate. Now, again, that is not something that is unique to Picasso, but there are things that are unique characteristics to Picasso. But you see what I'm saying? I mean, it is, you need to get close to these works, to these prints, and really study them to have a real appreciation for them.
Well, I have been looking at them for many, many years, and I still see new things in there. The vocabulary here is so rich, and there's so much in there that you never cease to be amazed by it. And if you have the time and really look around, you will see that there are many, many different techniques used, and each technique is precisely suitable for what he wants to express. But he is not an artist who just does one thing over and over again. Everything he does is something new and something innovative and very, very expressive.
So techniques like what?
Well, if you look at that, that's called, this is complex now, it's called sugar leaf etching, which
you're talking about the smaller
print? No, the big one.
Oh,
there.
The bigger one, okay.
I don't see from here.
Okay, well, yeah, I can't see it either.
That large one is a sugar leaf technique. It's a very difficult, complex technique. It involves a certain fluid which they put on the plate, which is diluted with sugar, and then etch it and so on. But the next, but to you or the right, towards the left here, is a lino cut, which he took up late in life, very late in life, in the 1960s. And he did 2 or 3 years, he did 150 or 200 different images. And if you see there, for example, that semi-abstract head, that's done with a needle. It's an engraving. So every one of them is different and in approach. And that makes it him a genius because he finds the right tools to express what he wants to do.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk and a Smart Talk road trip. We're coming to you today from the Susquehanna Art Museum on 3rd Street in Midtown Harrisburg, where the exhibit that is here at the Susquehanna Art Museum between now and September 22nd actually started in June, but you can see it until September 22nd. Picasso, A Life in Prints, if you're just tuning in. Yes, we are broadcasting live from the Susquehanna Art Museum, but within feet of 45 Picasso prints. And I have to say that, and we'll be talking about this a little bit later in the program, but for Central Pennsylvania to be able to get an exhibit like this, with this kind of prestige, and an artist like Picasso is really says something about the Susquehanna Art Museum, and this is not something you get to see every day, and especially in a city the size of Harrisburg, a region like Central Pennsylvania. So I greatly encourage you to come out and to take a look. Our guest during this portion of the program is John Soki. John, this is his exhibit. These are these Picassos he's collected over the years. He owns the John Soki Gallery in New York. As I said, he is the guest during this portion of the program. Before we go any further, I just want to mention that Smart Talk Road Trips are supported by Roof Advisory Group, and we're very appreciative of that. So, John, how does one begin collecting prints by Pablo Picasso? I know you also collect prints by Edvard Munch of the Scream fame, but how did you begin collecting Picassos?
I really cannot give you a straight answer because it was a thirst I had. Like, I just had to have it. And it didn't start with Picasso. I just like art. I was an accountant by training, and I can tell you I did not like that. But on the weekends, I went to see galleries, and I just enjoyed it. And I started very small with silly little things. But then the more you look, the more you see. The more you see, the more you enjoy. And it just filled my life. Wonderful. It's a wonderful thing to really be able to enjoy on a level, on a special level, these artworks, or any artwork for that. But Picasso and Munch, to me, are the two. One who speak to me the most.
When you say speak to you, in what way?
I can't tell you. It's like we all know we have a good meal and we say that was a wonderful dinner,
right.
It's a great drink or a nice movie. This elevates me to a level which is special and it gives me a high. Mm.
So how do you actually go about purchasing a Picasso? Or a monk.
That's not difficult if you have the wallet.
Really? Yeah. I imagine that you have to have the resources.
Right.
Yeah.
But my advice always to people: study. Get books on the artists you like. Look at them. You don't have to read the text. Sometimes that's silly, but you look and you will find as to what you like and what speaks to you. And if it has staying power, and go to museums, go to, as I said, buy books and so on, just follow it. And now with the internet, it's probably very easy to hook up with other people who are into it. I had made thousands of mistakes, but I constantly refine my collection. I constantly work on it. They are all my friends, these people, this on the wall. And you just learn. Whatever you can invest in terms of time and energy will come back to you tripled, a quadruple in joy.
When you started, was it because this is a Picasso or the piece itself, the artwork itself, you said, oh, I love that. I've got to have it. And my second part of that question is, are there Picassos or Munchs out there that you looked at and said, you know what, I really don't like that?
Well, Picasso did just on prints, we call them multiples, over 2,000, about 2,000.
See, that you anticipated quite. I was wondering, we have 45 of them here, yeah. 2,000 prints.
2,500 different images. Mm-hmm. So do I like them all equally? No. But I certainly have my favorites. I would say one favorite I could not name you, but I could name you 10 favorites or so. And there are some ones which I don't even understand, but that's all right, because you know he made that many works. How can you like them all, or how can you relate to all?
What was the first one that you purchased?
First Picasso I purchased. I don't remember because I probably don't have it anymore.
Mm. So you are selling too?
I have a gallery and it's a commercial enterprise in a way. I don't make a big living there. It's, as long as it sustains itself, I get the joy out of it. So as long as I pay the rent and so on, I have no trouble just coasting along. And I have a lot of people calling me up with questions because I'm somewhat of an expert in it. And I am happy to discuss these things, and I don't send a bill afterwards. It's not like a dentist.
By the way.
I hope I don't have any dentists here.
By the way, I wanted to tell our audience that we encourage you to, we have a microphone here that if you'd like to step up and ask a question of John Sobey, I mean, we don't get this kind of knowledge very often here in central Pennsylvania. If you'd like to step up, ask a question, make a comment about the exhibit, your observations, go right ahead. In fact, we encourage you to do that. Always like to engage with the audience one-on-one. What question, when you say that, you're considered an expert, what questions do you get most often? Is there one or two that you get most often about Picasso?
A lot of the questions are technical, and those are difficult to answer because these are very, very complex. And I myself sometimes cannot answer it, but my wife is a printmaker studying in Paris, and she really knows her stuff. If I'm in trouble, I ask her.
And it's always a good idea.
Yeah, always.
Yeah.
Dinner is better than
yeah.
And a lot of question about value, and a lot of question about authenticity.
Those are the two things I would think that anyone who is in your position is asked about. Okay, give me a ballpark of a value of a Picasso.
You can get a decent little print in a relatively large edition for around $1,000.
Hmm.
And the most expensive print, Picasso print, which has a recorded history, was $6 million. And I unfortunately know it because I bought it.
But $1,000, that would probably surprise a lot of people.
Yeah, but if you know the right place to go and don't fall for some kind of a frame shop trick or something, you can get little things, and they just as precious as something big and famous.
Right. We know that forgeries with any artist is that is a real problem. How often are people trying to forge a Picasso?
Very often. Not a Picasso, the signature is the problem. There are forged Picasso prints, yes, but very few. It's an expensive process, and if somebody wants to forge something, they would probably try a painting or a drawing, which is more costly. But there are some, and I myself bought some, because sometimes I buy things sight unseen, and then I pay the price. I have some forgeries also, but the signature is what's a big question here. And many of times I buy something with a signature, and the first thing I do is remove the signature because I know it's not right.
Like, in what way? You can recognize Picasso's signature?
No, nobody can, because he lived to be 92 or something. There's a big book. It's like 10 pages of sample signatures. So you can't be 100% sure ever, really. But mm-hmm. You can get pretty close.
Well, when you look at these prints, he didn't have like a normal, everyday, just sign it like the print or the piece like everyone would with a signature. I mean, it is unique.
It is unique, and when you sign 100 or 200 times, it varies a little bit. There are giveaways. For example, an early signature from 1904, 1905 is different from a 1933 signature or a 1964 signature. And certain things should not be signed. A lot of people don't know that, and they think everything should be signed, and it's not signed, and I know it should not be signed, so when somebody shows me a signature, I know it's the wrong signature because he didn't do it.
What you're pointing out also about the life of Pablo Picasso is he lived to an old age, 92, and... Okay, 92, most people don't live to be that age. But also, even from his earliest years to his latest years, he was working.
He worked day and night. He really believed that he was put on this earth to produce artwork. And he as older he got, the more he wanted to work, because he felt that he still has a lot to say.
When you look at, and you talked about the signature, but you look at the artwork itself, what are some of the big differences between his early prints? I mean, the very first one is probably one of the most well-known, was in 1904, and then look at some up until the late 60s.
Well, the subject matter changes a great deal. The early work is really about the people who he lived with. He lived in an area of Paris where the street entertainers and circus people lived. And a lot of the early themes are those poor people, a lot of alcohol, and so on. And the later work is about friends, memories, death. It's a whole different world.
When you read biographies of Picasso, and I'm sure that people like yourself, an expert on Picasso, they sometimes are identified as different eras in his life. The blue period, for example. Mm-hmm. What was the blue period?
The blue period is in the 1900-1905 area. The artwork is extremely strong because he was the youngest. He was the fullest with energy. And he did some wonderful, wonderful paintings. And those paintings are all in major museums. But the specific event, which is related to, he had a friend called Casagemas, and Casagemas was crazy about this woman, and he wanted to marry her, and the woman kept on turning him down, and eventually he actually wanted to kill her and then commit suicide, And he tried to kill her, but he missed, but he didn't miss when he shot himself. So the woman stayed alive, actually went home with Picasso, and Casagrimas died, and that shook Picasso up really, really bad. I mean, he was just 20 years old. It was a terrible experience. But I don't really believe that he wouldn't have come to that point without... I believe that he would have come to that point without this incident also. That was a natural progression. And then from blue, he went to the pink, and so on.
Refer to it. But, I mean, are those colors involved in blue, pink, the roses, are they involved in his artwork at all, or is that just his mood at the time?
I think this is his mood, but you never know with these things. You know, events happen and then people make stories around it. That's art historians do that. So maybe he just went to the store and all they had is blue paint, and that's how it started. I don't know.
I don't know if that's a satisfied answer for a lot of people who call to ask
who
questions.
Knows? Who knows?
And by the way, we have a few minutes left with John. If you have a question or a comment, step right up to the microphone and ask your question. So what medium, we established right up front at the beginning of the program about how versatile that Picasso was. What medium was he best at, or was his favorite?
Okay. Picasso had in his life three printers who he worked with. And these three printers, he printed with many other printers, but with these three special people, something happened, and I usually say 1 + 1 = 3, because when they got together, magic happened. And the first person who, the etchings which he did, a guy called Lacourier, and most of those are Lacourier prints. And you can see the quality, the richness, it's just, I can see it from here how special they are. There's no weakness there. And then that happened in 1927, 1928. And right after that, in the early 30s, he did the Suite Vollard, which is a monumental big project. And I followed the other two.
You finish up.
Okay,
we'll get to our guest.
Then the second printer he met, he was a lithographer. Murlo is his name, and you see some of them there. Eric Murlo, Mourlet. And that was in 1945, and between 45 and 55, they did a lot of fantastic lithographs. They are fuller pictures because there's more surface they print from, and usually larger. And then late in life, in the early 60s, he met this guy, Arnera, who was a commercial poster maker in south of France. And he did the lino cuts. And he did about 200 lino cuts in the matter of two and a half years. And the wonderful part of that is that the lino cuts are colorful. Or the etchings and most of the lithographs are black and white. But the lino cuts have a lot of color and they have size.
So why is that important? Because I noticed that with each description, there's a card next to each piece here, describing it and who printed it and that kind of thing. Why is it important?
Each technique gives you different possibilities, different size, different subject matter, different expression. So every one of them has strengths and weaknesses to the extent that, like with etching, the colors are very difficult. There is one portrait somewhere here of a small woman's head with a, I don't see it from here. That's the only etching, and four or five of the same, which he did in color of etchings. And then you see a lino cut, which is over there, that one, and there's another head somewhere, which you showed me earlier.
Yes.
Those are very colorful. Mm. So every one of them has... You have to find the right technique for the right image for the technique.
We have a member of our audience who has a question. Where are you from? Your name and where are you from?
I'm Ingrid Guderle from Liverpool, Pennsylvania.
Oh, okay.
So I had a question about, you said that Picasso didn't name his works, and I found that very interesting. I'm a poet, and I find naming my poems one of the hardest things to do, but I also find it an integral part of the writing process. And I'm just wondering if he ever mentioned a reason why he didn't name his
artwork?
What
I think.
Do you have an idea of why?
I think he was working so fast that once he was done, he moved on and he didn't want to be bothered. That's very similar with Munch. Munch had the same issue that he kind of left the titling to other people sometimes.
Mm-hmm. I have to admit that's one of the things I found most interesting as well. I had never heard that either. But other people getting to name your work seems a little bit unusual.
What it tells them, I guess, that he reads them. But, you know, for him, as I said earlier, it was his diary. So that's what happened that morning, which he's depicting in some way. Or he spent the night with one of those women there on the wall. And then, you know, it's kind of difficult.
Revealing his secrets, I guess.
No, you can recognize it, but it's a special feeling. It's nobody's business in a way. Right. So really we sort it by date. And people title it. And as I said, every book you pick up, you have a different title for the same work.
Well, I guess that allows the viewer to have make their own meaning of what they see.
Yeah.
But yet they do have the prints to have names today. Yeah. How did you choose for the exhibit? How did you choose those titles?
I go with there's many books on Picasso called quote unquote definitive books on the. There is one which I work with. It's called the Bear, and it's just a big book with descriptions and titles. So because people call you and they say, I have this thing called Gillo, and I say, it means nothing to me. Oh, its name is Gillo. I said, it means nothing, because he did 200 pictures of Gillo. So we really go by the number, and then there is no misunderstanding.
Mm. We have another question. Sir, your name, Jim, where are you from?
Jim Davis, Hummelstown. I have a two-part question. Number one, did you start collecting before Picasso's death? And number two, being that he died in the late 60s or whenever.
Early
70s. 1973. Yeah.
70. Have you ever had the opportunity to meet him?
That's a wonderful question, because I get it all the time. And my answer is, happily, I never met him. Because I have him on such a high esteem that it only could have pulled him down from that pedestal. Because he was in his late 80s, 90s, he was totally secluded. His wife wouldn't let him talk to anybody, and it would have been a negative experience.
What was the first question, though?
The collection before he died. Did you start collecting before?
No. There was a big show in the early 80s, but he was there already in the MoMA in New York, the Museum of Modern Art. And that's really the first time I got a complete sense as to what he's all about.
We have another question from the audience.
My name is Ashley Forsberg from Mechanicsburg, and I was just wondering if you could talk about the activism that was mentioned in some of the information.
You're talking about him being a communist, you're referring
well,
to?
Well, it mentioned that he was involved in activism efforts in Spain during the war.
He was a very forceful personality. Little guy, he was like 5'2 or something like that, but he had tremendous force in him. And in social situation, in romantic situation, he just overpowered everybody. So as things changed in his life, he did get involved in certain movements and worked with certain artists and certain writers and so on. And just like that was his personality. He did not play around. When he dwelt into something, he was in 100%. In the early, late 40s, he got involved in communism that had something to do with WW2, and he went to Poland for a big communist meeting. And then he was asked to, for the Stalin's, I don't know, 70th birthday or something, make a drawing of Stalin. And that was rather unusual, because usually he did what he wanted to do, but he made a portrait of Stalin, which came down on the front page of the communist newspaper. But Stalin didn't exactly view himself the way Picasso did it. So that was the end of communism.
Wow. We have another audience question. Before I ask this, I want to follow up with something we're just saying. That Picasso, during World War II, when the Nazis occupied France, Paris in particular, that Picasso stayed in Paris during World War II. How did he, and we know that Hitler and the Nazis, that many artists left France, left Paris. Now, he was not Jewish, but still.
His grandmother was Jewish, and in
see,
Jewish,
that would have been enough.
In Jewish religion, it goes on the wife's side, the woman's side. Yeah.
That would have been enough in World War II. So how did he survive, thrive, while this is all going on?
He was not thriving. He was very nervous because he was, in a way, in a strict sense, illegal because he was Spanish. And those days, I guess they didn't have visas or something like that, but he wasn't really a Frenchman. So he was very, very concerned. It was a very difficult time. And if you look at his artistic output for those years, they very weak and very scarce.
And because of this fear?
He was concerned. Mm. Yeah, he was very concerned.
Let's take another question from the audience. Ma'am, your name and where are you from?
My name is Birutha Hansen. I'm an artist. I live in Liverpool, Perry County also. I want to share with you one of my favorite quotes that is attributed to Picasso, and as evidenced by the amount of work that he produces. It is very significant for artists. Inspiration exists, but it must find you working.
That really is very, very sincere, and I'm glad it helps you.
Well, thank you very much. John, we're almost out of time for this portion of the program. I want to thank you very much for being with us, bringing this exhibit to Harrisburg for Central Pennsylvania, and really outside of Central Pennsylvania. I'm sure we have a lot of people from outside the region who visit as well, for bringing it to Central Pennsylvania. What's the takeaway? What do you, when someone comes to enjoy this exhibit, what do you want them to walk away with?
Well, I would say that, I don't know this for a fact, but what I hear here is that this is not something which happens every day here. So it's wonderful that this can be seen here and enjoyed. And if you have a good feeling, if you feel that it added something to your day, that in itself is wonderful. And if you now get interested and maybe order some books or travel a little bit to Philadelphia or whatever, Washington, and go on and build on this experience, that's even better. So I am just happy that I could do this. I'm thankful to Alison who beat me up and got it out of me.
And we'll talk to Alison Schwab in just a moment.
And I'm just pleased as a punch to be here.
John Soke is art collector and director of the John Soke Gallery in New York. John, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. Thanks.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk and a Smart Talk Road Trip. We're at the Susquehanna Art Museum today. Smart Talk Road Trips are supported by Roof Advisory Group. The Susquehanna Art Museum is a real treasure here in central Pennsylvania and throughout the region. Now, just think about this. Not many museums in cities the size of Harrisburg have an exhibit with the works of Pablo Picasso. But here to talk about the museum is Alison Schwab. She is the executive director of the Susquehanna Art Museum. Ms. Schwab, thank you very much for being with us today, and thanks for having us here today.
Thank you for coming. We're just delighted. We don't often have a crowd this size in the gallery, as you can see.
What do you think? We have maybe 90, 100 people?
I think
like
so.
But, you know, it is, you were talking before we went on the air about things happening here at the museum other than just art connoisseurs, those who enjoy art, walking through and looking at the artworks. You have a lot of activities here, so you brought that up.
Yeah, we're a non-collecting museum, so we don't have a collection, and everything that we bring to the public, we change over every 3.5 months or so. And so we have, along with that, sort of what we call engagement activities, things that people can do within the context of the museum. We think that's important, and I think we're not alone in that. Museums are discovering that just having amazing artwork on the walls sometimes isn't quite enough.
I understand that there's a backstory as to how this exhibit got to the Susquehanna Art Museum in Harrisburg, the Picasso, A Life in Prints. Tell us the story.
Well, I worked for John in the 1980s. I hate to date myself.
And he keeps, you were very young.
He keeps asking me, do you remember this? Do you remember that? And we've stayed friends for all these years, and it was a great experience for me to work with him in New York City. I have an amazing staff here. We have a staff of four, and each person besides me does something very astonishingly fabulous programmatically. And Laura Nye, our director of exhibitions, goes to all our staff, our Ross Tiger, Dina Sell, they all go to museums and galleries all the time, and they are doing research all the time. And Lauren was in John Sokey Gallery in New York and then wrote to him. And she wrote an email saying, I wonder if you would ever be willing to bring your work to Harrisburg. And John responded, yes, Lauren, but I only will consider when I run things by my Pennsylvania consultant, Alice Ann Schwab. Well, I had just arrived here at the museum, and they don't know me from anything, and Lauren's like, what the heck is this? So John was being his typical joking self, and that led to our talking about this timing and how we would do that, and really, it's John's collection, but Lauren curated it, and Lauren looked at the work, and then there was a bit of negotiation to get this show as it is. We felt it was very important to do that life imprint, that story of Picasso's life, that you could actually, studying this, really take away a slice of Picasso's life.
You just didn't want a Picasso or a few Picassos in the museum. You wanted a life imprint.
Yeah, well, yeah, we'd always take a
awesome. Wouldn't yes, turn it down, right?
But yes, that's what we wanted to tell, a story, and this is the story that we got to tell because of John's the breadth of his collection. But I'm not going to say that Lauren had a particularly easy time, because sometimes works sold, and so there were lots of changes and adjustments that needed to take place. But all good. Yeah.
So when you say negotiate, I'm not going to talk dollars and cents, that kind of negotiation, but I assume that you looked at some of the prints that you would like to have here, and I don't know whether it was with John in person or, you know, who you dealt with, but is that how it actually worked when you negotiate? Is here, you know, we want to do a life imprint of Pablo Picasso, and here are some of the artwork that we would like to have. Is that how it went?
Yep, just how it went.
I just answered my own question. Well, how unusual, and I don't want to make a big deal out of this, but how unusual is it for an art museum in the city the size of Harrisburg or in central Pennsylvania, a region like central Pennsylvania, to have a Picasso exhibit like this?
Well, this is a very special collection, so I think it's very unusual indeed. There are folks, there might be some folks in this room who have a Picasso of some sort at home. There are ceramics, and there are you know, lots of folks who have images. For us to be able to know that the work is all fully legitimate, that the provenance is not questionable, that's a huge thing for us to be able to bring that level of show to Harrisburg. And again, we could just have a print here or you know, a work here and spread it out with a lot of other artists of that time period or go with a different theme. But for us, we wanted to tell this story, and so we were able to do that with John's collection.
So even museums are concerned about the authenticity?
Yes, they are.
See, you know,
it is the museum's worst fear that there will be an exhibit and something comes up along the way where the provenance is now questionable.
See, you know, the reason I ask that question is that I get the sense that, you know, I think that anyone who is an art connoisseur and enjoys art realizes that there are a lot of forgeries out there. But my guess is that there are many people, when they walk into a museum, say, oh, it's in a museum, so we know it's authentic. You're smiling. It doesn't work on the radio.
Well, I mean, you sort of have answered your own question there, but to say yes, for us it's very important when we have an exhibit of any artist that we're able to document its authenticity. Mm. And so that's a big part of what we need to do always with this exhibit or others.
I want to switch gears with you. Susquehanna Art Museum, you're on 3rd Street in Midtown Harrisburg. Midtown Harrisburg is an area that has grown so much over the last decade or so, especially with so many cultural locations. Mm-hmm. But you're going on your fifth year here. You were on Market Street in Harrisburg. What's the difference? What has this location brought to the Susquehanna Art Museum?
Well, this room that we're sitting in is the main gallery is climate controlled. That's humidity as well as temperature. And it's also secure. So those kinds of things weren't necessarily always possible in rental locations. The museum board of directors wanted to find a space of our own that we could control, we could be in control of, and that would give other lending organizations, other museums, collectors, the assurance that when they loaned their work to Susquehanna Art Museum, it was going to be well cared for and well maintained for the duration of the exhibit. So every time we deal with a different entity, we are very observant of the number of lumens that are allowed, that work is allowed to experience, and the climate. As we sit in here, feels a bit chilly often to people, but it's always a 70 degrees and 50% humidity.
Mm-hmm. There are art galleries throughout central Pennsylvania. In fact, many of the cities in the region, that's how they are bringing people into their cities, is through art. What's different about the Susquehanna Art Museum? What's unique?
Well, I do think our non-collecting perspective allows us that every time you come, you'll see something new. For some people, that might be disappointing, that we don't have a collection that they know. They'll always go to a certain corner and see a certain work of art. But we like that fact that we're always engaging the community with a new challenge. We have not only our main gallery, we have three other exhibition areas on the downstairs of the museum. So anytime you come, chances are really good that you'll be seeing something new here, and we like the fact that we can always do that. But as we were talking about earlier, we love the fact that we have the space that we can allow people to engage in sometimes other activities in the context of the art. The people doing yoga here say that it really informs their practice to be able to work in this space and with artwork happening on the walls or sometimes on pedestals nearby. And to do a figure drawing, if you're an artist and you want the opportunity to draw from a live model, we do figure drawing with two live models staged for about 20-minute poses in this space, and everyone has an easel and the different poses are there. Artina does a magnificent job of helping people who are just for their first time doing figure drawing to become more comfortable with that. There are many experienced artists, and she lets them go, but perhaps makes some suggestions. So all that happens within the context, in this case, of Picasso. In other exhibitions, we've done figure drawing as well in this space, and it's just a cool experience.
We only have about 60 seconds left. I want to thank you very much again for having us here and bringing this exhibit to Central Pennsylvania. But what's your vision for the Susquehanna Art Museum?
Well, our vision continues to grow as far as being a part of this Midtown community that you described. We're partners and friends with a lot of our neighbors, the Midtown Scholar down the street and all of the restaurants and the brewery up the street. And we want to kind of encourage this as to be the arts district. We're very friendly with the State Museum of Pennsylvania. This is just down the street. And we try to do things that are collaborative. I've just this week been engaged in three different collaborative entities with other arts organizations and with other community partners. And we want to be that place that people can come and experience the arts in all of its greatness.
Alison Schwab is the executive director of the Susquehanna Art Museum. Again, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Scott.
This Smart Talk Road Trip, supported by Roof Advisory Group. On tomorrow's program, we talk about easing into retirement. Back in the studio tomorrow, that's coming up on Smart Talk. Have yourself a good day. Again, Alice, thank you very much. Everyone here in the audience and listening out there, enjoy your day.